Texas Fish and Game Magazine, September-October 2024, audio edition. In this issue, Hunting Without Corn, Bait-Free Tactics for Hunting Feeder-Shy Bucks, The War on Predator Hunting, How Anti-Hunting Groups Are Making It Harder to Hunt Predators, Even in Texas, Teal Season Safety Tips. The early teal season has dangers that shouldn't be overlooked. Dove Delights. Tasty treats to celebrate the year's first hunting season. Gear up for a cast and blast on public land. Plus columns, outdoor news in the Fish and Game Report, coastal focus reports by professional saltwater guides, and more. So listen, learn, and enjoy. Oh, what a tangled web. Inside Fish and Game by Roy and Ardia Neves, Texas Fish and Game Owners and Publishers. From time to time, we use this space to report on changes, updates, and challenges related to our adventures in cyberspace. As many readers know, Texas Fish and Game has had a presence on what old-timers call the World Wide Web since the early days of CompuServe and screeching modems. We launched www.fishgame.com in 1995. In the succeeding decades, we have gone through a number of site overhauls, all of them frustrating and painfully slow, and never quite meeting our expectations. And so now, on the threshold of the site's 30th year in existence, we've embarked on another effort to redesign it. Website creation and design in 2024 is supposed to be easy peasy, according to the ads you see everywhere from services like GoDaddy, Wix, and 100 others. Got a business? Upload your logo, a few photos, and a list of your products and/or services, and voila, minutes later your site is up and running and your user traffic is piling up. But in our business, it just doesn't work that way. As a media outlet, our main product is the site itself and the content we create. We do have physical products, shirts, books, and our magazines, Fish and Game, and Lakes and Bays, but it is the stories that we produce and curate that draw visitors to the site and hopefully keep them coming back. Since we've been doing this for so long, there is a lot of content. In our favor, we're not a conventional news media outlet, so most of what we have in our archives is evergreen, not perishable like breaking news stories. A story about time-honored techniques for catching largemouth bass during the spawn, or targeting bull reds in the fall, or stalking late-season bucks, has no expiration date. This makes it imperative for us to keep all of this material available and easy to access. Our site has more than 11,000 articles, and more get added on a daily basis. And while some of our content is reporting on stories from other sources that Editor-in-Chief Chester Moore personally curates, most of our content is original, created by Chester, Lenny Rudow, and the other members of our pro staff. There is no algorithm scraping the work of other sources and passing it off as ours. So the task of improving the way all this content is presented is no small endeavor. We've had our team, Troy and Melinda Buss and Sharon Hare, working on it for the better part of the past year. We started rolling it out this week. The goal is to make the site cleaner, organized better, and most of all, faster to load and deliver the information you're looking for. Check it out at fishgame.com and let us know what you think. Breaking the sound barrier. One of the first things we did as a part of our site renovation was to incorporate audio into our stories, allowing you to listen to them. We began this process with the articles in the digital editions of the magazine. These audio versions are quite good and make it easier than ever to take our digital issues on the road or water. You can download the entire issue and listen to it anywhere, anytime. Our plan is to phase in audio versions of as many of the non-issue articles posted on the site as well as those in our digital magazine editions. Stay tuned. A great loss, but a grand and lasting legacy. Bob Seeley, who with his wife Donna founded the Big Bass Splash Tournament series, died in July after a hard-fought battle with cancer. Bob was a lifelong avid fisherman who was also a visionary entrepreneur. In 1984, he envisioned a tournament series that would enable everyday anglers to compete in pro-level tournaments with the opportunity to take home pro-level winnings. The Big Bass Splash made a huge splash of its own in the world of amateur competitive fishing. Thousands of anglers were drawn to the tournaments, first held on Seeley's home lake of Sam Rayburn, later spreading to other Texas lakes and then to venues in other states. Bob's contests were distinguished not only by the big payouts, but also by his own stage presence. As gifted a showman as he was a businessman, Bob knew how to keep an audience riveted to the action at his events. Those events have contributed millions of dollars to charities such as Ronald McDonald House and St. Jude Children's Hospital. We've been partners with Bob and Donna for almost 30 years, and count them, and their daughter Nicole, who now runs Seeley Outdoors, as cherished friends. Bob Seeley will most certainly be missed, but his legacy will outlive us all. Email Ardia at aneves@fishgame.com. Email Roy at rneves@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. A Texas Boy in Grizzly Country. Editor's Notes by Chester Moore, Texas Fish and Game Editor-in-Chief. It felt like paradise. The little boy who grew up seeing pictures of men fly fishing in Montana streams, in sports afield, field and stream, and outdoor life, was doing it as a man. Rainbow trout were biting and hitting a dry fly fished in the Cherry River fishing access area just outside of Bozeman, Montana. I had just caught a nice rainbow that jumped as if it were a sailfish when I heard grunting in the tall grass behind me. I was on the stream's edge, down a rock embankment that was about 10 feet above me at a distance of 25 yards or so. The grass was tall leading to this spot, and as I gently turned my head, I saw movement. Whatever was in the bushes grunting was black with grizzled gray. Was it a bear? Perhaps even a grizzly? This particular location was out of the range of common grizzly sightings, but it was still technically in their range, and black bears were certainly in the area. I decided not to do anything out of the ordinary and to keep casting. I heard the grunt again, but this time a single grunt, muffled by increasing winds blowing from the mountains in front of me. I had just arrived from a delayed flight and hadn't yet bought bear spray. I had no way to carry a sidearm in this location, and the stream wasn't deep enough to retreat into and drift down in case it was a bear. It's not like they can't swim. Suddenly I hear the lapping of water. Almost afraid to look, I turned my head to the right, and there stood a poodle. It was one of those big, standard poodles. This old poodle was black with grizzled gray and was grunting as it drank. It sounded as if it had a really bad cold. I was never so relieved to see a poodle in my life. I walked down and gave it a pat on the head, and about that time, I heard someone hollering, "Susie! Susie, come here!" I walked up the bank and saw a man with desperation in his eyes. "Are you looking for a poodle?" I asked. "Yes, sir. She got away from me, and I was concerned a bear or mountain lion might have gotten her." "No, she's down at the stream drinking," I replied. Susie saw her owner and ran to him, grunting all the way. I couldn't help but laugh at the poodle and myself. Here I was in Montana, and my first close encounter was with a poodle. Ha! The next morning, I found myself in the incredible Lamar Valley of Yellowstone National Park. As the sun rose, the silhouettes of American buffalo, bison, dotted the horizon. Truly wild bison are a rare commodity, and seeing them in person is a powerful experience when considering their nearly extinct status 120 years ago. While slowly driving through this incredible setting, a couple of beautiful pronghorn caught my attention. I pulled over to take some photos. Another gentleman had just stopped to do the same, and as we adjusted our lenses, his wife shouted from their truck, "Bison!" Turning around, we found ourselves nearly eye to eye with a massive bull bison, and he looked angry, really angry. The whites of his eyes showed as he grunted at the distance of about 15 feet, which means we were about 0.5 seconds away from 1,500 pounds of fury. We gently backed up, and then a couple of other bison that just crossed the road caught his attention. He immediately ran out and slammed into one of them. The other, younger bull, struck back, but then ran off, leaving the big bull on its own. He then proceeded to roll in the dirt, grunt, and buck up and down like a bronco. Yes, this was the same bison that walked right up to us a few seconds earlier. Bison hurt more people in Yellowstone than any other animal. People look at them as large cattle from the dairy farm because they are unafraid of people in the park. It's called confidence, people, not docility. I'm well aware of bison dangers, and in fact avoided fishing in what looked to be an incredible spot in the Lamar Valley due to bison presence. Not only were there big bulls, but lots of babies there. Being between a mama bison, a calf, and a fishing hole is not a good idea. I fished elsewhere and did quite well. This trip not only brought me information, but clarity. Sometimes only being in wild places does that for me. I'm just glad I'm writing a column about my bison encounter instead of being the subject of a story someone else wrote. Wildlife journalist attacked by bison is not a headline I want to read anytime soon. The phenomenal trip would also include bighorn sheep, wolf packs, an actual bear sighting, and a lot of trout. But the big takeaway was when you're in the wild, be prepared for anything, even an old coughing poodle. Email Chester Moore at cmoore@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Cal's Last Column. Editor's Notes by Chester Moore, Texas Fish and Game Editor-in-Chief. Calixto Gonzalez was a valuable contributor to Texas Fish and Game for many years. Starting off writing hotspots reports for the Lower Coast, former editor-in-chief Don Zadel saw his talent and quickly started having him do features. When I came on as executive editor, Cal was the first and only choice to replace me as saltwater editor. He was real, he was unique, and he had heart. Miles and miles of it, in fact. The first I heard of Cal was when a Louisiana guide service had some writers from Texas and Louisiana over to a lodge in Johnson Bayou, Louisiana, to gather content. I had been assigned to go do a destination piece in Arkansas for Texas Fish and Game, so I had to decline the invite. A friend of mine called after the event and said, "Who in the heck is this Calixto Gonzalez guy? It was super tough fishing. He caught the only big trout that we could use for photo purposes and released it." That intrigued me. I later learned it was simple. He believed in catch and release of truly big trout. He was doing what Cal often did, living out his beliefs despite the consequences. Cal and I bonded over professional wrestling. We both loved it our entire lives. When he told me he used to drive Dirty Dick Murdoch around during his latter years of wrestling in Texas, his cool factor went way up. Cal and I also bonded over this. No one would have picked us to make it in the outdoors business, or at least few would have. Here was me, the long-haired guy in metal bands, and Cal, the red-headed Hispanic dude with a snarky sense of humor and wit that went over most people's heads. But we both did, and we both ended up in Texas Fish and Game, which we talked about being so special to us frequently. At some point, Cal started missing deadlines. It happens. It's happened to me. But it was a lot. And it was always some wild explanation of some sort of health calamity, and some of them sounded maybe too wild to be true. I'll be honest and say at one point, I thought Cal might have some real health issues, but maybe he was exaggerating. I was unfortunately very wrong. Cal had many health issues, and left behind a loving family during the peak of the COVID pandemic. He passed away in a Houston hospital at a time none of us could go see him. I had spoken with Cal about 6 months before the pandemic, and he was doing good then. But he asked me then, "Hey pal, if I pass away, could you write my last column?" A tear rolled down my cheek, and I said, "Of course, my friend. It would be an honor, but it's an honor I hope to never do. I want you to be with us as long as we exist at Texas Fish and Game." When Cal passed, I knew in my gut it would take a long time for me to write the column. I tried immediately and then deleted the file. It didn't honor Cal correctly. TFANG owners Roy and Ardia Neves and I, as well as few contributors, wrote a tribute, but I couldn't get the column done. It wasn't the right time. He transcends outdoors media. As an educator, he put deep love and mentorship into young people. As a man, he fought hard for what he believed in. And as a friend, he always put a big smile on my face, like when me, Cal, and Dustin Warnke did one of Dustin's podcasts together. I hadn't laughed that hard in years. This will officially be Cal's last column. I finally found a way to give Cal a send-off worthy of his awesomeness, and it was inspired by a little boy I met in Wyoming. The little boy lost his mother, has no father in his life, and has had some issues fitting in with people. He was smart, he was funny, and he so loves the great outdoors. He reminded me of some of the kids Cal would talk about that he had helped. He always wanted the poor underdog to enjoy the great outdoors as much as the in crowd. So, in Cal's honor, I sent him a rod and reel combo. And through the first September edition of the Texas Fish and Game e-newsletter, we will post a story asking for kids that might be dealing with special challenges. We will give away 5 rod and reel combos in honor of Calixto Gonzalez, my friend and a friend to Texas Fish and Game. Our very last conversation ended up being about our mutual faith in Christ, so I know Cal is in a truly better place. I wish he was here with us, and I wish his column still ran on our pages. But I am glad I can finally write Cal's last column and make it a vehicle to help those less fortunate connect to fishing. Cal might have wanted us to throw in some Lucha Libre masks to the kids too, but I know he would have been overjoyed to see that his legacy still carries on powerfully. Cal, I miss you, buddy. The greatest honor I have ever been asked to do in my career is writing your last column. I love you, and so do a whole lot of other people. Email Chester Moore at cmoore@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. The Most Missable Missiles, Doggett at Large, by Joe Doggett, Texas Fish and Game Senior Contributing Editor. Many wingshooters agree that the mourning dove is our most missable bird. The mourner is the smallest of our significant game species, weighing a smidgen over 4 ounces, an ounce or so less than the chunky white wing. And it flies fast. Based on studies done by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the mourning dove hits high gear at around 40 miles per hour and redlines on a honking south wind at 50 plus. And when hastened by an errant pattern of pellets, a dove is capable of an amazing gauntlet of twists and turns and dips and dives calculated to confound even a veteran September gunner. Teal appear to be a close match, but the diminutive ducks are slower than doves. Both blue wings and green wings look faster than they are. Flight studies peg them in the 30 miles per hour range, lagging most big ducks like mallards. Teal are shifty little rascals, but the flocks usually are fragmenting over decoys out in front. There's no such thing as the typical dove shot. The mourner is a justifiably challenging target, and a clean miss is nothing to be ashamed of, assuming an incomer is not trying to land on your head. So, what is a reasonable average? During the 60s, when I was a fledging wingshooter, the big 3 outdoor magazines, Field & Stream, Outdoor Life, Sports Afield, routinely stated that the national average on mourning doves was 1 bird bagged for each 7 shots. That woeful statistic persisted for several decades, and I never did accept it. I still don't. That's terrible shooting. Most of the guys I have hunted doves with over the years probably went 1 for 2, maybe 1 for 3. 1 for 4 was a bad day. They were, and are, good shots. But nothing extraordinary, just avid wingshooters with average coordination and proper equipment and considerable experience. That is my honest recollection from more than 60 years of dove hunting. A slick trick is to bag a limit inside a box. That would be 15 birds on the current limit with no more than 25 shells, a snappy performance in most any gunslinging company. This is especially true on a slow hunt when the hunter must take 'em as they come. Here are several proven observations for upgrading the average in the dove field. Using an improved cylinder or skeet choke is a great way to look good. Most high percentage shots at incomers and passing birds are within 20 to 35 yards, and the open choke throws a wide, dense pattern of 7.5s or 8s within that range. When pass shooting or jump shooting, when most chances are at 40 or beyond, a modified or full choke is the better choice. Standing under a flight line of flocks trading from feeding fields to water or roost is a classic example of the specialized pass shooting drill. Walking a goat weed field or corn stubble and flushing long birds feeding on the ground is a good example of jump shooting. And when 40-plus gunning is the plan of the day, you might leave the El Cheapo waterhole loads in the truck and equip with premium 7.5s or even 6s. Frankly, near or far, quality shot shells are never a bad idea on a serious dove hunt. A few extra dollars per box is cheap insurance. Regardless of hunting method or choke selection, using discipline can be a major factor in improving the average. Granted, practice is the best way to upgrade performance on difficult angles and distances, but if you increasingly are frustrated over a growing mound of empty shells, you might pass the next awkward chance with tangled feet or confounding lead. Yet another flaming miss, followed by sweaty epithets, erodes confidence. Back off, settle down, and wait for an ice cream shot. A hot dove field allows this option. Discipline also means knowing the terrain and avoiding shots that might drop a bird into heavy brush or over an irrigation levee or property fence line. A clean kill means little if the bird cannot be recovered. Bam, bam, bam is ruinous for a decent average, so avoid emptying an autoloader or pump at long range as an unscathed dove zooms past. Repeated three-shot salvos surely delight shot shell manufacturers, but they seldom do much for adding fluff to the game bag. Obviously, a double gun only goes bam, bam, but the reasoning is the same. Either way, the first shot out past 40 yards almost always gives the best odds of a hit. After that, let it go. You are about to swing through the unworthy realm of sky blasting. The exception would be if the first shot dusted the dove. Then empty the gun and hope you can rake the cripple down. A proven way to pad percentages on incomers is to turn 40-yard shots into 25 or 30-yard pokes. This is not a luau. You are hunting. Wear drab clothing, use low cover to break the hungry profile, and strive to station in cooling shade. But avoid burrowing into an overhead tangle of branches that restricts the high field of view. You are waiting and watching for doves, not armadillos. If circumstances allow, place several decoys, and when a bird is within clean range, rise to the occasion slowly and smoothly without frantic waving of arms and gun. The same goes when walking and getting caught off guard. Over you! Over you! Don't lurch for cover or try to outdraw Ike Clanton at the OK Corral. Early season doves are accustomed to casual pedestrian movements, so just ease to an indifferent halt and keep your cheek down on the stock as you thumb the safety and pivot and swing. Texas is the nation's motherlode of dove hunting. A new season is approaching, and it promises to be a good one. I'm ready with my old Winchester Model 12 and my new Dove Gear Ultimate Bird Vest and a sack of Mojo decoys. And as always, I hope to make that first shot count. Email Joe Doggett at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Time to target jetty jumpers. It's prime time for sharks and tarpon. Feature article by Chester Moore. What is that? My fishing partner, and now former Texas Fish and Game colleague, Nicole Becca, asked me and our boat captain, Robert Scherer. As she pointed toward the tip of the Port Aransas jetties, several long black fins stood out of the water. At first, I had no idea when I was looking, but when a flash of silver caught my eye, it became obvious. Tarpon. A school of silver kings were feeding on mullet about 50 yards south of us, and now our attention switched to them. As we cast everything in the tackle box at them, Nicole finally got a hookup on a topwater. It didn't last long, but we got a big thrill watching the 4-foot tarpon bust out of the water and show its deep red gills as it shook its head. Tarpon are a fairly common sight at the Port Aransas jetties, and also at the jetties in Port Mansfield and Port O'Connor. Officials with the state's Tarpon Observation Network, TON, report that each year, anglers target Texas tarpon near shore with some success. Although current tarpon populations are not what they once were, conservation efforts have led to increased opportunities for Texas anglers. Typically, in late summer and early fall, anglers pursue tarpon with a fair degree of success. Now is the time when tarpon begins schooling in areas such as the stretch between High Island and Galveston, around Port O'Connor and Port Mansfield. TON advises that most tarpon are often hooked incidentally while fishing for other species. However, the tarpon's habit of supplementing oxygen intake by gulping air, often referred to as rolling, can alert anglers to their presence. Tarpon are opportunistic carnivores, feeding on a variety of prey. Anglers typically use dead or live fish for bait, such as menhaden or mullet, but live crab, live shrimp, and artificial baits, including flies, that resemble bait fish or shrimp, can tempt a hungry tarpon as well. The hard, bony plates in their mouths make tarpon difficult to hook, but circle hooks have been found to provide the best hookup ratios. Due to the presence of sharp gill plates, anglers typically use long 80-pound test or heavier leaders to prevent cutoffs. Nonetheless, hooking a tarpon and bringing it to hand is easier said than done, with most hookups resulting in the tarpon winning the battle. Although contact with tarpons is rare for us, another acrobatic oceanic predator is abundant, and we catch many: sharks. Sharks, particularly black tips and their close cousin the spinner sharks, put on extremely impressive acrobatic displays, arguably outdoing even tarpon. The easiest spot to find sharks is around jetties or nearshore oil and gas platforms. Bring along some chum like menadon oil, or throw out chunks of poji to attract the big fish. Canned jack mackerel also makes great chum and is very inexpensive. All you have to do is punch holes in the can and put it in a lingerie washing bag or fish basket tied off to the boat. Another economical chumming method involves taking a 5-gallon bucket, punching it full of holes, and rigging weights in the bottom. Tie the bucket to the boat with enough rope to sink at least 10 feet down and fill it with fish guts, old shrimp, cut menhaden, or any kind of smelly stuff. This will create a chum slick that will draw in sharks from all around. A few years ago, two of our fine law officers, Jimmy Owens and Jason Laughlin, invited me out to chase sharks at the jetties. When we arrived, there were few big ones to tangle with, but the rocks were swarming with hundreds of black tips from 2 to 3 feet in length. We decided to try our luck with topwaters and had a blast for several hours watching the feisty predators chase and occasionally destroy our top dogs, she dogs, and super spooks. If you think you had fun with topwaters, try catching sharks on them. It takes things to a whole new level. If you want to purposely get sharks to come to the surface to hit topwaters, try taking out a pail of wet sand or mud and live glass minnows or finger mullet. Take several of the bait fish, clump them up in the sand, and throw them overboard. The fish will escape at different depths, driving the sharks crazy. Once they start surfacing, you can skip the sand and just throw over the live bait to keep them surfaced. Over the years, fishing jetties has provided some of the most interesting experiences of my life. There was the time my father hooked into a stingray that weighed well over 200 pounds. It took him and my cousin Frank Moore on a 2-mile ride. I was in another boat and lost contact with them after we started catching fish. After a frantic search, we approached Frank's boat to find my dad lying in the bottom, drenched in sweat, and Frank now fighting the behemoth that was now flapping on the surface. "What are you going to do with it?" I asked. "Son, I fought it for 2 hours. We're going to eat it." And by the way, the meat was great. Nowadays we would not kill such a big ray, but it was hard to argue with Dad's logic back then. Many of you have had amazing jetty and other nearshore Gulf encounters as well. There have been millions of man-hours spent chunking spoons and fishing shrimp under a popping cork along these fish superhighways. Don't think for a second that you can't enjoy these kinds of encounters in an aluminum boat. You must exercise extra caution in any smaller craft, of course. But as you can see, my adventures have been many. The first day my schedule meshes with calm winds, you can bet I will be there, chasing hard-fighting fish and expecting the unexpected. Thanks for listening. East Texas Ducks: Where to Hunt Ducks in the Piney Woods. Feature article by Matt Williams. We're on the cusp of another duck season in Texas, and Clay Shipes is anxious to see how things shake out on lakes and rivers across the Piney Woods. Shipes knows a thing or two about ducks and duck hunting. He is Texas Parks and Wildlife's regional migratory game bird specialist for East Texas. The 35-year-old biologist began his career with a well-spent 4-year stint at the 25,000-acre J.D. Murphrey Wildlife Management Area, a wintering waterfowl wonderland near Port Arthur, then hired on with Ducks Unlimited, overseeing multiple states across the southeast. Shipes returned to Texas in 2020, and he's been riding shotgun over eastern Texas ever since. The biologist spends a wealth of time afield throughout the year. Come fall and winter, his 20-gauge is always close by. When he isn't duck hunting, he's thinking about it. "Duck hunting is pretty much my passion," says Shipes. "I do most of my hunting on public waters." Shipes says there is no shortage of sweet spots across the Piney Woods for duck hunters to stage a decoy spread. Experience has taught him the best hunting prospects always happen when the right conditions are present. The biologist said the most important factors to consider are water conditions, food, and hunting pressure. Some of the best shoots occur when there are plenty of groceries available in the shallows to attract birds and hold them when they pass through the area. This is especially true for dabblers like early teal, mallards, shovelers, pintail, and gadwall. Dabblers feed primarily in the shallows, often in water so skinny it can barely float a decoy. The birds will eat insects and other invertebrates, but they love to munch on new growth, terrestrial vegetation, and seeds they can easily reach in a feeding posture that sometimes puts their heads beneath the surface and their butts in the air. Mudflats ripe with flooded vegetation on any number of public reservoirs can be magnets for migrant teal looking for a spot to loaf and recharge for their journey south. The same is true for second-growth rice fields spurred to life by timely rains. One thing to note is ducks are usually most attracted to new water and new food sources when areas are freshly flooded, Shipes said. In the Piney Woods region, we are really dependent on water and landscape-scale flooding that opens up large areas of habitat for ducks. There was certainly no shortage of water in eastern Texas as late spring gave way to summer. Some reservoirs were several feet above normal in late June after big storms in late April and May caused major flooding in parts of the region. How last spring's high water will stack up for fall hunting prospects depends on what happened in the months that followed. Shipes said the best-case scenario would be if the summer turned off dry enough that sun-baked shorelines were able to grow some dense stands of successional seed-producing plants. Then, come fall and winter, we start getting steady rains that flood these areas and set a dinner buffet ripe with goodies. The good news about that is we have water, and hopefully it helped grow some good stands of submerged aquatic vegetation during the summer, he said. The problem is that we had very little to no early successional seed-producing plants because all of our wetlands were standing in water. Last year, we struggled with water, and there was little to no habitat available for birds. Most likely, the rain stopped at some point this summer, Shipes added. With the wet conditions we had going into summer, it shouldn't take too much moisture in the fall to provide water and habitat for ducks in our region come fall-winter. Hunters should be sure to focus on areas where there is food available, especially if it's newly flooded. They also need to look at areas where they will be able to hide. That's one of the biggest mistakes I see, not doing a good job of hiding from incoming ducks. Top 5 picks. As earlier mentioned, there are a number of good duck hunting lakes in eastern Texas, but some have much richer histories than others. In the following segments, Shipes highlights his top 5 Piney Woods duck hunting waters. Number 1, Lake O' the Pines. Size, 18,700 acres. Controlling authority, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Comments: it's a large reservoir with plenty of submerged aquatic vegetation in certain years. The best hunting typically occurs at the lake's shallower upper reaches around expanses of hydrilla and other aquatic vegetation. The lake is known for supporting large numbers of diving ducks like scaup, buffleheads when the conditions are right. Number 2, Toledo Bend. Size, 181,600 acres. Controlling authority, Sabine River Authority. Comments: it's a massive reservoir where good hunting can be found in large expanses of cypress swamps, creeks, and backwater areas up and down the lake on both the Texas and Louisiana sides, some of the best at the shallow northern reaches. The North Toledo Bend Wildlife Management Area is a well-known hotspot when not overrun with giant salvinia. Hunters must have an annual public hunting permit to access the area. Shipes says swamps and backwaters are prone to holds large numbers of gadwall, and it's not uncommon to see rafts of divers in big open water areas. Number 3, B.A. Steinhagen, Dam B, size 10,647 acres. Controlling authority, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Comments: downstream from Sam Rayburn on the Neches River, it's a shallow reservoir with an abundance of aquatic vegetation like hydrilla, American lotus, and non-beneficial water hyacinth and giant salvinia. Good hunting also awaits upstream in flooded oxbows. Hunters with dogs should be cautious, especially during the early teal season, as alligators are present. Shipes says Dam B has a rich history of holding large numbers of divers, primarily canvasbacks. Number 4. Caddo Lake. Size, 26,800 acres. Controlling Authority, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Comments. It's a shallow natural lake shared between Texas and Louisiana. Large expanses of bald cypress span the scenic water body, along with abundant native and non-native aquatic vegetation. It holds plenty of resident wood ducks and attracts good numbers of canvasbacks, scaup, widgeon, teal, gadwall, and mallards when the weather elements set up right. Shipes says waterfowl use hinges heavily on the giant salvinia. It's usually best in seasons following floods that flush the noxious plants downstream. Number 5. Lake Livingston. Size, 90,000 acres. Controlling Authority, Trinity River Authority. Comments. Texas' second largest reservoir is built on the Trinity River, which acts as a major corridor for migrant waterfowl winging their way south for the winter. Shipe says there are a number of large, shallow flats and creeks at the lake's upper reaches that can hold large numbers of puddle duck when the conditions are right. Teal, gadwall, and mallards will fill most straps. Best lakes for early teal. Blue-winged teal are the predominant species found on Piney Woods waters during the early season. Shipes says naming the region's best teal lakes is difficult because the birds are very unpredictable, prone to move through the area very quickly, and usually don't use the same areas from year to year. You hear a lot about people killing teal on several different lakes, but the ones I hear the most about are Toledo Bend and Caddo, Shipes said. This has to do with location and depends highly on the food available from year to year. Thanks for listening. This may come as a shock. Texas Freshwater by Matt Williams, Texas Fish and Game Freshwater Fishing Editor. If you forget everything else you read here, remember this. It could save your life. Where there is thunder, there is always lightning. And a lightning bolt knows no boundaries. Lightning has been known to strike objects as far away as 12 miles from the storm that produced it. Being outdoors when lightning is a possibility is risky business. I've interviewed a couple of anglers over the years who were struck by lightning and lucky enough to live and tell about it. In 1996, Toledo Bend fishing guide Stephen Johnston got popped while guiding a pair of off-duty firemen. I've told his story before. It is always worth retelling in the name of boating safety. Johnston didn't own a cell phone at the time, and weather apps didn't exist. Television forecasters had predicted storms to move into the area around noon, so Johnston figured they would have a few hours to fish in the morning. The guide said the skies turned hazy about mid-morning, and a light drizzle began to fall. There hadn't been any lightning or thunder to speak of. Nothing, Johnston recalled. Next thing I know, I'm sitting on the front deck, straddling the trolling motor, facing to the back of the boat. I still had my fishing rod in my hand, and I remember looking down at my hand. My index finger and thumb were glowing like the cap on an orange magic marker. I couldn't feel my left arm or leg. Johnston said one of his clients dropped to the floor. The other was knocked out of the back seat and onto the rear deck. Luckily, everyone survived. Johnston thinks the lightning hit his fishing rod and exited the boat through the transom-mounted transducer. The electrical surge fried the boat's wiring harness, fuse box, and electronics. It also killed three bass his customers were holding in the live well for photos later on. That day definitely changed my thinking about lightning, Johnston said. I used to be one of those who waited to hear that first clap of thunder before I got off the water, but that doesn't work for me anymore. Nowadays, I'm able to use my cell phone to keep close check on the weather. If bad weather is coming, I'm long gone before it gets there. We were lucky that day. Dangerous as it is, lightning doesn't kill near as many people as you might think. National Weather Service data shows lightning kills about 20 people each year in the United States, while injuring hundreds of others. Some survivors suffer lifelong neurological damage. Between 2013 to 2022, 19 people were killed by lightning in Texas, according to figures from the National Lightning Safety Council. Texas ranked second behind Florida, 51, in lightning-related deaths during that time period. Bottom line, lightning is nothing to be messed with. Neither are big winds. High winds can turn a calm reservoir into a dangerous sea of tall rollers in a matter of minutes. Last May, a nasty storm blew in on Toledo Bend and caused a 28-foot pontoon boat to capsize. The boat was occupied by 6 people, 2 of which drowned. If the forecast calls for 15 to 20 miles per hour winds, it's a safe bet it will be ripping across unprotected water. The bigger the water body, the longer the fetch area for tall waves to build. Getting caught in rough water in a boat can spell disaster, especially in a small boat. You can also get into trouble in a bigger boat, especially if the driver lacks experience. Operating a boat safely in rough water takes skill that can only be learned from time on the water. If high winds are in the weather forecast, it might be smart to boat another day. Otherwise, adjust your launching and fishing locations to wind-protected areas to avoid getting into a bind. This is especially true on large bodies of water. Boater Ed Mandatory. Texas is a mandatory boater education state. Completion of a boater education course, or a TPWD prescribed equivalency exam, is required of anyone born on or after September 1, 1993, who operates any vessel over 15 horsepower, wind-blown vessel over 14 feet, and all personal watercraft on Texas waters. Children under 13 are prohibited from operating a PWC unless accompanied on board by a person at least 18 years of age who is legally authorized to operate one. To operate a vessel alone in Texas, a boater must be 13 years of age to operate a vessel of more than 15 horsepower, or wind-blown vessel over 14 feet in length, and meet boater education requirements. Boaters can find a selection of online boater courses that can be taken anytime on the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's Boater Education webpage. In-person courses are available. Paddlers can also access a free paddling safety course online. Fees for the course start at $11 for a basic course and vary depending on in-person or online courses. For more information on boater education in Texas, check out tpwd.texas.gov/education, Boater Education. It is worth noting that the Bass Anglers Sportsman Society recently announced that proof of completion of a boater education course will be required of all anglers competing as boaters in BASS fishing tournaments, regardless of age. The only exceptions are high school and junior events, where competitors are not allowed to operate the boat. The new rule becomes effective in January 2025. BASS says the submission of proof of a completed course is a simple, one-time process and is valid for life. Email Matt Williams at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Hunting Without Corn: Bait-Free Tactics for Pursuing Feeder-Shy Bucks. Feature article by Chester Moore. Texas deer hunters are spoiled. Let's admit it. Most deer hunting is done by putting out a feeder, driving an ATV to a stand, and sitting and waiting. Oh, there's plenty of effort involved, and sometimes a whole lot of time in the stand, but it's not like hiking miles into public land, carrying a climbing stand, and waiting over an unbaited area for a deer to walk by. We sometimes get the idea that hunting with feeders is the only way, but the fact is some deer, especially some big bucks, become feeder shy. Feeder shy deer, particularly mature bucks, often avoid areas with heavy human scent or regular disturbances. These deer learn to associate feeders with potential danger, especially in heavily hunted areas. As a result, they become more elusive and harder to hunt using conventional methods. However, these same bucks can often be found near natural food sources, which they perceive as safer and more familiar. The first step in hunting deer without feeders is scouting. Texas is diverse, with habitats ranging from dense forests to open plains, each offering different natural food sources. Key foods for deer in Texas include acorns, persimmons, wild grapes, and various forbs and browse plants. Oaks are abundant in many parts of Texas, and acorns are a staple in a deer's diet. Look for areas with high oak tree density, particularly where white oaks grow, as their acorns are preferred by deer due to their lower tannin content. Persimmons are another excellent food source, and these sweet fruits are highly attractive to deer. Identify persimmon trees in your hunting area and note when they are fruiting, which generally occurs in the fall, aligning well with deer season. Wild grapes, plums, and other native fruits can also draw deer, often found in forest edges or clearings. In areas without abundant mast, nuts, and fruits, deer rely heavily on forbs, broad-leaved herbaceous plants, and browse, leafy parts of woody plants. Identifying areas rich in these plants can lead you to deer hotspots. Once you've identified potential feeding areas, the next step is setting up your hunting location. This involves understanding deer movement patterns and positioning yourself advantageously. Use trail cameras to monitor activity around natural food sources, helping you identify when deer are visiting these areas and establish their movement patterns. Place cameras at varying heights and angles to cover a broad area and avoid spooking deer with visible equipment. Position your stand or blind downwind of the feeding area to avoid detection, as mature bucks are particularly sensitive to human scent. Ensure you account for prevailing wind directions and set up your stand at a comfortable distance, allowing for a clear shot while remaining concealed. Utilize natural cover to your advantage. Hunting from ground blinds made of natural materials, or positioning yourself in thick brush to enhance your concealment. Avoid cutting too much vegetation, as it can alert deer to human presence. Understanding when to hunt is as crucial as knowing where to hunt. Deer are crepuscular, meaning they are most active during dawn and dusk. Plan your hunts around these peak activity periods for the best chance of success. Arrive at your stand well before dawn for morning hunts, minimizing disturbances and allowing you to settle in before deer begin moving. Be prepared for a longer wait, as deer may not appear until the first light. For evening hunts, set up in the afternoon and remain patient until dusk, as deer often move towards feeding areas as daylight wanes, making evening hunts particularly effective near natural food sources. For those looking to take their hunting to the next level, consider incorporating advanced techniques such as spot and stalk or still hunting. Spot and stalk require patience and stealth, scanning open areas and using binoculars to spot deer from a distance, then carefully stalking your prey using terrain and vegetation for cover. This technique is particularly effective in open plains or lightly wooded areas. In places like the Big Thicket region of Texas, this is nearly impossible. Still hunting involves moving slowly and quietly through the woods, stopping frequently to listen and observe. This method requires excellent knowledge of the terrain and deer behavior, as well as the ability to remain silent and undetected. This can be problematic on deer leases because hunters are often limited to fairly small areas, so keep that in mind and be safe when even remotely approaching someone else's hunting area. Creating mock scrapes and rubs using deer scent can also attract bucks, relying on natural deer behavior rather than food, making it a viable alternative for those avoiding feeders. Hunting deer without corn feeders offers several distinct advantages. Without the concentrated human scent and activity around feeders, deer experience less pressure and are more likely to follow their natural patterns. This method challenges you to develop a deeper understanding of deer behavior, habitat, and movement. Pursuing deer in Texas without using corn feeders or bait is a rewarding endeavor that tests your skills and knowledge as a hunter. By focusing on natural food sources, understanding deer behavior, and utilizing strategic setups, you can increase your chances of success and enjoy a more authentic hunting experience. Whether you're a seasoned hunter or new to the sport, embracing these techniques will enhance your appreciation for the challenges and rewards of hunting deer in Texas. We're not saying stop feeding. In fact, these kinds of hunts aren't always easy. So you might find yourself back on the stand, waiting for the 4:30 corn dispensing to begin. But it offers a way to pursue deer in a different way that might connect you with the big bucks that are avoiding your feeder like the plague. Thanks for listening. And away we go. Texas Whitetails by Larry Wysoon, Texas Fish and Game Whitetail Hunting Editor. I had been putting out Vineyard Max every chance I had. The near 7-hour drive was one I did not relish making until I could start seriously hunting in October. Thankfully, a friend agreed to put out the aromatic and nutritional Vineyard Max bait in an area I had found far from any existing deer feeder or deer blind. I had found the middle-of-nowhere spot the previous fall while walking and rattling. I had struck off across county with my rattling horns walking at 45 degrees into the wind, stopping every quarter of a mile to rattle. It was during one of my rattling sessions. A most interesting buck had charged in and was gone before I could raise my rifle, something that occasionally happens when rattling. The buck was a massive 10-point, main beams spreading well outside his ears, with tines nearly a time and a half the length of his ears. I saw him long enough to guesstimate he gross scored in the high 150s B and C. His clean hocks, skinny neck, and other age-indicating body characteristics suggested he was certainly no older than 4. Because of his age, I was glad he did not hang around very long. I fear I might have talked myself into shooting him, breaking my self-imposed 5 years or older minimum age if he had. The buck much reminded me of another I had seen in northeastern Texas, where I hunt with friends who own the ranch. His antlers were nearly as big, although not quite as wide. The West Texas buck, rattled in, was nearly 20 inches outside. The northeastern Texas buck also appeared to be no older than 4. His spread was barely 17 inches outside. His tines and beams were easily as long, and I suspected more massive. I passed him knowing if he lived at least one more year, he could become a buck to write home about. Both bucks made it through the 2023 hunting season. I saw them just before they cast their antlers in mid-March. Thanks to fortuitous rains during the antler growing season, deer on both properties and many others have not had a hungry day this year. I spent time on both properties during late August, conducting our annual nighttime spotlight census, and spent several days looking for deer to get a good idea of current buck-to-do ratios and fawn survival rates. I spotted both bucks, and both have grown bigger bodies and antlers. I very seldom, if ever, use trail cameras, and even when the landowners do, I do not care to see the photos they procure. I like hunting old style. Scouting the property hoping to spot bucks, I plan to hunt in real life and then going one-on-one with the chosen deer. If I come out on top, hooray. If the bucks come out on top, same hooray. As our 2024 whitetail season approached, I sighted in my Mossberg Patriot bolt-action rifles in 6.5 PRC and 7mm PRC, www.mossberg.com, topped with Stealth Vision scopes, stealthvision.com, my open-sight Rossi lever-action rifles, rossiusa.com, and Long Eye Relief scoped Taurus Raging Hunter revolvers, www.taurususa.com, with appropriate Hornady ammunition. All are ready. I will not be hunting opening day of our Texas 2024 archery MLDP season. I'll be in British Columbia, Canada, hunting moose. But I can assure you, as soon as I return, I will be hunting Texas whitetails. I have several bucks, including the two I passed last year, and I am hoping to encounter this fall and winter, as well as others. My intention this fall and winter is to take whitetails, both bucks and does, with the guns mentioned. I will continue using Vineyard Max to draw deer into the middle of nowhere, targeting those bucks which seldom, if ever, show up at corn feeders. I will also be using Vineyard Max to concentrate does in remote area. Does will attract bucks as the rut approaches. Later in the season, when I am hunting does to harvest our quotas, I will be using Vineyard Max to toll them away from established feeders and normal hunting areas, so those areas are not associated with hunting. I will remind you of one whitetail fact when it comes to taking an older, mature buck. Always my goal with bucks. The best time to take a buck of size and age, which you know something about, is the first legal opportunity. If you do not bow hunt and hunt on property not under a MLD permit, you might consider getting a crossbow and becoming proficient with it, which does not take long. Not unlike the proverbial early bird getting the worm, the early hunter quite often gets the big buck. Email Larry Wysoon at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. The War on Predator Hunting. How anti-hunting groups are making it harder to hunt predators, even in Texas. Feature article by Paul Fusinski. As a hunter and conservationist, the importance of preserving our outdoor heritage for future generations is vital. The recent attacks on predator hunting across the United States serve as a reminder of the incremental yet dangerous threats posed by anti-hunting groups. They are methodically using predator hunting, arguably the low-hanging fruit of the hunting world, as a means to introduce higher restrictions on hunting laws, a strategy often referred to as the death by a thousand cuts. Here we dive into how the shortening of the coyote hunting season in Michigan, driven by public perception rather than scientific evidence, parallels the current ban on canned mountain lion hunts in Texas. The issue at hand is far more significant than the mere reduction of hunting seasons. It represents a fundamental challenge to our rights and hunting traditions. Recently in Michigan, the Natural Resources Commission, NRC, decided to close the year-round coyote hunting season for 3 months, from April 15th to July 15th. This decision was based on unsubstantiated social pressures rather than scientific evidence, thereby limiting the opportunities for Michigan hunters to manage coyote populations effectively during this period. Michigan is representative of a broader nationwide trend of chipping away at hunting rights. The NRC's decision prioritizes public perception over sound scientific management, a dangerous precedent that threatens the entire conservation community. When decisions are guided by social perceptions instead of science, we as hunters risk losing not only our hunting opportunities, but also the effective management of wildlife populations that are responsible for the healthy, huntable numbers of animals. In Michigan, the NRC's actions were not based on any concrete data or scientific studies. Instead, they relied on wildly vague notions of public perception without providing any evidence to back up their claims. To add insult to injury, these restrictions were put on the table by trapping and hunting groups, likely due to perceived pressures from anti-hunting groups, whatever that means. If we continue down this path, it won't be long before other hunting opportunities, ones much closer to the species you prefer to hunt, are similarly restricted, leading to an erosion of our hunting rights. The significance of predator hunting, particularly for species like coyotes, extends beyond the act itself. Predator hunting plays a crucial role in managing wildlife populations and maintaining ecological balance. In conservation, dollars are already stretched thin and resources limited. Hunting is, as part of the North American model of wildlife conservation, a vital resource for the control of game species. That is partly why we are required to buy game tags and often report harvest numbers, so state DNR agencies can keep track of how many individual animals are removed from a population every year. This data is then used to steer regulations that control populations of game species to keep the numbers healthy and sustainable. Anti-hunting groups are well aware of the implications of these incremental restrictions. They view all common methods of predator hunting and trapping as objectionable and aim to use public perception to further their agenda. It's much easier to show a gruesome image of a dead coyote and cute coyote pups to appeal to people's emotions than it is to explain the complicated and nuanced reasons as to why hunting and management are necessary to keep animal species healthy across the board. The parallels between Michigan's coyote hunting restrictions and Texas's ban on canned mountain lion hunts are striking. In both cases, the decisions were driven by social and emotional governance rather than sound biological science. In states like Colorado and California, we see the long-term effects of such terrible policies. These states have experienced a gradual degradation of hunting opportunities, with trapping and other methods of predator control being outlawed. This slippery slope is a real threat, and hunters must remain vigilant to prevent similar outcomes in their states. As hunters and conservationists, our passion is driven by a desire to ensure that future generations have the same, if not better, opportunities to enjoy the outdoors that we all love so much. The fight to preserve predator hunting is about more than just a 3-month coyote season or canned bay mountain lion hunts. It's about safeguarding our hunting heritage and ensuring that sound science guides wildlife management decisions. The Michigan United Conservation Clubs, MUCC, is actively challenging the NRC's decision. They are filing an appeal and requesting the administrative record of the decision to understand the basis for this flawed policy. Their approach is grounded in scientific research, which clearly shows that localized management of coyote populations during the spring period is essential. They presented hundreds of pages of peer-reviewed research to the NRC, demonstrating that the spring period is the optimal time for managing coyote populations. unless there is any shred of evidence that hunting is directly degrading the overall health of a species population, whether it is coyote, mountain lion, deer, or raccoon, hunters should be up in arms anytime their right to hunt is challenged, especially since we are footing the bill for the conservation efforts that keep these populations healthy and in balance. Despite the best efforts of MUCC, the NRC's decision was influenced by social perceptions, ignoring the scientific evidence. It's important to remember that this is not a battle against public opinion, but a fight to ensure that wildlife management is guided by the best available science. We must vehemently resist the trend towards social and emotional governance and advocate for policies based on sound biological principles. That is what we, as hunters, are paying for. Every hunting license, tag, gun, bow, and box of ammo purchased is funding all the science-based research going into maintaining healthy, huntable populations of game species. The attack on predator hunting is a critical issue that affects all hunters, regardless of their preferred game. The recent decisions in Michigan and Texas highlight the dangers of allowing social perceptions to dictate wildlife management policies. We must stand together and advocate for science-based management to ensure that future generations can enjoy the same hunting opportunities that we cherish. It has been proven time and time again that the North American model of wildlife conservation is effective, conserves wildlife, and is self-sufficient in its funding. No matter if implemented in America, Africa, or anywhere in the world, it simply works. When hunters band together and protect wildlife while enjoying the fruits of their conservation dollars, everyone wins. Let's protect our heritage and resist the erosion of our hunting rights. Thanks for listening. Teal season safety tips. Feature article by Texas Fish and Game staff. The early teal season in Texas is an exciting time for waterfowl hunters. It offers the first crack at ducks and gives dog owners a time to get some real in-the-field training as well. With that said, early teal season has some inherent dangers that should not be overlooked. Texas wetlands and marshes, prime teal hunting grounds, are also home to alligators. These big lizards pose a significant threat to both hunters and their retrievers. When hunting, always scout the area during daylight before the hunt to identify any potential alligator signs. Alligators are most active at dawn and dusk, the same times hunters are usually in the field. Keep your retriever close and avoid sending them to retrieve birds in areas where alligators have been spotted. If you must hunt when gators are present, use a boat to retrieve downed birds or do it yourself, cautiously. Very few gators will pursue a person, but many will go after a dog. A vigilant eye and cautious approach can prevent tragic encounters. Additionally, training your retriever to respond immediately to commands is crucial for their safety. A well-trained dog that returns promptly when called can avoid many dangers. Also, keep in mind, gators are not just on the coast. There are gators throughout the eastern third of the state, and in some river systems, a couple of counties removed from the Gulf. Early teal season coincides with the peak activity of snakes, including venomous species like cottonmouths and rattlesnakes. These reptiles are often found in the same wetland areas where teal are hunted. Wearing snake-proof boots and gaiters can provide an extra layer of protection for hunters navigating through tall grass and swampy terrain. For your retriever, keep them on a leash or under close control until you have thoroughly checked the area for snakes. Training your dog to avoid snakes can also be life-saving. Various trainers offer snake avoidance training, which conditions dogs to recognize and steer clear of these dangerous reptiles. The early teal season in Texas is notorious for its high temperatures. The combination of physical exertion, heavy gear, and humid conditions can lead to heat exhaustion or heat stroke. Hunters should dress in lightweight, breathable clothing and stay hydrated. Carry plenty of water not only for yourself, but also for your retriever. Take frequent breaks in shaded areas to cool down. It's important to recognize the signs of overheating in dogs, which include excessive panting, drooling, and lethargy. If your retriever shows any of these symptoms, cool them down immediately with water and seek veterinary care if necessary. By being cautious about alligators, prepared for snakes, and proactive in heat management, hunters can ensure a safe and enjoyable experience for themselves and their dogs. Thanks for listening.
Dove Delights, two tasty treats to celebrate the year's first hunting season. Feature article by Texas Fish and Game staff. Dove hunting is a cherished tradition in Texas, where the start of the dove season is eagerly anticipated as the official kickoff of the hunting season. Hunting is a year-round affair in Texas, with hogs and exotics, but as far as native game, doves are the first offering. Once the hunt concludes, the best part begins: dinner. Here are two delicious recipes to honor this tradition: bacon-wrapped grilled dove and dove and creamy mushroom sauce. Bacon-wrapped grilled dove. Ingredients: 12 dove breasts, deboned, 12 slices of bacon, 2 jalapeno peppers, sliced, 12 small cubes of cream cheese, salt and pepper to taste, toothpicks, barbecue sauce, optional. Instructions: 1. Prepare the dove breasts. Rinse the dove breasts under cold water and pat them dry with paper towels. Season both sides with salt and pepper. 2. Stuff the dove breasts. Place a slice of jalapeno and a cube of cream cheese in the center of each dove breast. 3. Wrap with bacon. Wrap each stuffed dove breast with a slice of bacon, securing it with a toothpick. 4. Preheat the grill. Heat the grill to medium-high heat. 5. Grill the dove breasts. Place the bacon-wrapped dove breasts on the grill. Cook for about 5 to 7 minutes on each side, or until the bacon is crispy and the dove is cooked through. Brush with barbecue sauce during the last few minutes of grilling if desired. Dove in creamy mushroom sauce. Ingredients: 12 dove breasts, deboned, 2 tablespoons olive oil, 1 onion, finely chopped, 3 cloves garlic minced, 1 pound mushrooms sliced, 1 cup chicken broth, 1 cup heavy cream, 1 teaspoon dried thyme, salt and pepper to taste. Instructions: 1. Prepare the dove breasts. Rinse the dove breasts under cold water and pat them dry with paper towels. Season with salt and pepper. 2. Sear the dove breasts. In a large skillet, heat the olive oil over medium-high heat. Add the dove breasts and sear for about 3 to 4 minutes on each side or until browned. Remove from the skillet and set aside. 3. Sauté the vegetables. In the same skillet, add the onion and garlic. Sauté for about 2 minutes until fragrant. Add the mushrooms and cook for another 5 to 7 minutes until they release their juices and become tender. 4. Make the sauce. Pour in the chicken broth and bring to a simmer. Reduce the heat to low and stir in the heavy cream and dried thyme. Simmer for about 5 minutes until the sauce thickens slightly. 5. Combine and cook. Return the dove breasts to the skillet, spooning some sauce over them. Cover and simmer on low heat for about 10 minutes, or until the dove breasts are cooked through and tender. Whether grilled to perfection with a smoky, bacon-wrapped exterior, or simmered in a luxurious creamy mushroom sauce, these dove recipes celebrate the unique flavors of this prized game bird. Each dish not only honors the tradition of dove hunting in Texas, but also brings family and friends together around the table to savor the fruits of their labor. Thanks for listening.
Gearing up for a cast and blast on public land. A special report compiled by Texas Fish and Game staff. A cast and blast adventure in Texas offers a fun mix of fishing and hunting that can happen on the same day or on the same trip. Most of this is done in the context of private hunting lodges and outfitters, which offer cast and blast packages as part of their services. For those on a budget, a fun way to do it is to hit public land. Yes, Texas is 97% privately owned, but we have ample land to do weekend or even week-long cast and blast trips that can be fun for the whole family. To make these fun and fruitful, you need to be well prepared with the right gear and game plan. Here's a detailed guide on what you need to bring, covering both freshwater and saltwater fishing, as well as hunting. License and permits. Fishing license. Before casting a line in Texas waters, secure a fishing license. This is mandatory for both freshwater and saltwater fishing. Check for any specific endorsements or stamps needed for certain fish species or regions. Hunting license. A valid hunting license is essential for pursuing any game in Texas, Be aware of the different types of hunting licenses available, such as those for residents, non-residents, and specific game. Special permits. Depending on the game or fish you're targeting, additional permits might be required. For instance, a federal duck stamp is necessary for hunting waterfowl, and certain areas may have unique regulations. A prime example of a potential surprise is that you need a free sandhill crane permit to hunt these beastly birds. Clothing, weather-appropriate gear. Texas weather can be unpredictable, ranging from scorching heat to sudden downpours. Pack layers, including moisture-wicking base layers, insulating mid-layers, and waterproof outerwear. A wide-brimmed hat and sunglasses are also essential to protect against the sun. Camouflage. Essential for hunting, camouflage clothing helps you blend into the environment. Choose patterns that match the specific terrain, whether it's woodland, marsh, or in the prairies. Comfortable boots. Invest in sturdy, waterproof boots suitable for both hiking and wading. Break them in before your trip to avoid blisters and discomfort. Safety and navigation. First aid kit. A comprehensive first aid kit is vital. Include items like bandages, antiseptic wipes, pain relievers, and any personal medications. A snake bite kit can also be beneficial in certain areas. GPS and maps. A handheld GPS device and detailed maps of the areas you'll be exploring are crucial. Familiarize yourself with the terrain and mark key locations such as your camp, water sources, and hunting spots. Hydration and nutrition. Carry plenty of water, especially in Texas's hot climate. Hydration packs or water bottles with filters are convenient. Pack high-energy snacks like trail mix, jerky, and energy bars to keep you fueled throughout the day. Freshwater fishing gear. Medium-heavy spinning rod. Choose a rod that's versatile enough to handle various freshwater species. A medium-heavy spinning rod provides the strength needed for bigger fish while maintaining sensitivity for smaller bites. Spinning reel. Opt for a smooth, high-quality spinning reel. A reel with a reliable drag system will help you manage the fight of a strong fish and prevent line breakage. Lures. Stock your tackle box with a variety of lures. Soft plastics mimic the movements of bait fish and are effective for bass. Crankbaits and spinners are a must. Also bring plenty of worms in your favorite colors. If you come across grassy waterways, they will nullify your hard baits. Hooks and weights. Bring an assortment of hooks and weights. Use smaller hooks and lighter weights for species like crappie and larger, stronger options for catfish and bass. Choose an 8 to 12 pound test line for general freshwater fishing. Heavier lines are better for areas with dense cover or larger fish. Net. A landing net is crucial for safely bringing fish to shore on public land. Often you will be bank fishing and most of the area is not easy to fish. A net can be a big benefit in getting the fish to shore. Cooler. Keep your catch fresh by storing them in a cooler with plenty of ice. Saltwater fishing gear. Surf rod. A long, sturdy surf rod is ideal for casting into the ocean. It provides the leverage needed to fight larger saltwater species. Saltwater reel. Saltwater reels are designed to resist corrosion from saltwater. Choose a reel with a strong drag system and high line capacity for handling big fish. If you plan on targeting sharks, make sure you're not undergunned. Even a 6-foot-long black tip can spool you. Lures. Equip your tackle box with spoons and live bait rigs. Live bait rigs are highly effective for species like redfish and trout. Hooks and weights. Saltwater fishing requires larger, stronger hooks and weights. Circle hooks are great for catch and release, as they tend to hook fish in the corner of the mouth. Line. Use a 15 to 20 pound test line for general saltwater fishing. Braided line is strong and has a smaller diameter, allowing you to cast farther. Fishing license. Ensure your license includes saltwater fishing. Waders. Chest waders allow you to venture deeper into the surf, increasing your casting range, and are especially important in the fall and winter. Most Texans don't use waders in the summer and early fall. Pliers. Saltwater pliers are essential for removing hooks from the toothy mouths of saltwater fish. Hunting gear. Rifle. Select a rifle appropriate for the game you plan to hunt. For deer, a 36 or 308 is a popular choice, offering good range and stopping power. For wild hogs, a 223 or 300 blackout can be effective. Ammunition. Bring enough ammunition for both practice and hunting. Ensure your bullets are suited for the specific game and comply with local regulations. Binoculars. High-quality binoculars are crucial for spotting game at a distance. Look for ones with a magnification of at least 8x to 10x. Rifle scope. A reliable rifle scope enhances accuracy. Choose one with good light transmission for dawn and dusk hunting. Game calls. Use calls specific to the species you're hunting. Deer calls can attract bucks during the rut, while hog calls mimic the sounds of feeding or distressed pigs. Rangefinder. A rangefinder helps determine the distance to your target, ensuring accurate shots. Game bags. Lightweight, breathable game bags are essential for transporting your harvest and keeping it clean and cool. Scent eliminator. Use sprays and washes to reduce your scent. By bringing the right gear and being well prepared, you can ensure a successful and enjoyable cast and blast trip in Texas. Whether you're reeling in largemouth bass in a tranquil lake or hunting ducks on the coast, this is a formula to have the trip of a lifetime. Thanks for listening. The Fish and Game Report. News of the Outdoor Nation, reported by Texas Fish and Game staff. Texas Bass Study yields surprising new data. Biologists from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, TPWD, have completed an innovative study that tracked the movement and behaviors of largemouth bass at Toledo Bend Reservoir and Lake Fork. The goal of the multi-year initiative, which launched in 2020, was to learn more about fish behavior and help anglers be more effective when they target largemouth bass. In 2018, anglers began reporting a decline in catch rates, and many assumed that these declines were attributed to decreased fish populations. Despite reduced catch rates reported in surveys of anglers during 2018-20, the electrofishing data that biologists gathered on fish populations remained consistent. Biologists wanted to explore if increased fishing activity on the lakes had altered the behavior of the fish, which in turn led to a decrease in angler catch rates. The study at Toledo Bend and Lake Fork focused on seasonal habitat use, the movement and home range of largemouth bass, and how it correlated with angling activity. It also explored the effects of boat motor noise and angling activity on fish behavior. On both lakes, biologists monitored the movement patterns of individual largemouth bass, ranging from 16 to 24 inches in length. Biologists implanted radio transmitters into 43 fish at Toledo Bend and 38 fish at Lake Fork to track them over a two-year period. When the results came in, biologists were intrigued by the movement and home ranges of largemouth bass. Some of the biggest surprises were the small home ranges that these fish actually had and how little of an area they occupied throughout the course of a year, said Jake Norman, Inland Fisheries Division, Tyler District Supervisor. I think most anglers, and even biologists, me included, expected to see more seasonal movement, especially of individual fish. Overall, we just didn't see that happen on a larger scale. For example, on Lake Fork, the average total home range these fish occupied was 60 acres or less over the course of the entire study, and the average core use area was just over 10 acres. Norman pointed out that the bulk of these fish have home areas and don't migrate throughout the lake. The time of year didn't seem to have a big effect on movement, and neither did the weather or lake levels. There wasn't a large movement of fish back and forth from the bank to offshore structure, said Norman. It highlights that some fish just like to stay in shallow areas, and some just like to be more offshore. Fish movement appeared to be the same throughout all four seasons and stable the whole year without a lot of seasonal movement. The study also revealed some interesting findings about boat noise and the subsequent reaction by fish when hearing a motor. Biologists indicated that 59% of all the relocated fish reacted to boat noise in some capacity. Norman added that fish size was a relevant indicator for how likely they were to react. They found that fish over 20 inches were more likely to react to boat noise. In addition, fish that were in vegetation reacted more often than when vegetation wasn't present. In terms of structure and habitat, the study found that in general, largemouth bass exhibited habitat preferences. The results of the study provide insight to anglers on how to target fish and to fisheries biologists in their approach to management. A big take-home of this study is how important it is to be as stealthy as possible when fishing for largemouth bass, added Norman. When anglers are sight fishing and see a fish on a bed, they should do everything they can to make a cast to the fish before it knows they are there. Truthfully, that should be the angler's mindset throughout all the seasons, no matter if they are fishing in a foot of water or 30 plus feet of water. Doing everything you can to be as stealthy as possible will increase your chances of catching the fish you are targeting. Overall, when it comes to locations, the traditional target spots proved to be the best when angling for largemouth bass. The fish in these studies still selected more of what I call high percentage spots, like drops, points creeks, and other habitat structure, said Norman. The places where anglers typically look for to target bass are the areas the fish are still utilizing the most. The study also shows that they are really educated and are very wary when noting an angler's presence, which could correlate to the reported lower catch rates. The study indicated that fish could also be found in featureless flats, areas that typically had less pressure from anglers. However, in those areas, they were more spread out and less concentrated. The results could also present fisheries managers with two different approaches to habitat installment and enhancement. The first is to concentrate efforts in the high percentage areas, and the second would install more habitat in the flats to help concentrate more fish into a small area around the habitat structures. In other news, artificial reef program enlarges Sabine site. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, TPWD, Artificial Reef Program, in partnership with the nonprofit organization Friends of Sabine Reef, have added a fourth artificial reef site to the Sabine Pass area. This new 20-acre reef, named HI 54 Shallow, is approximately 8 miles from the Sabine Pass jetty and 1.7 miles from the coastline of Sea Rim State Park. High 54 Shallow will consist of artificial materials that will be deployed to help create a new artificial reef habitat for aquatic life, as well as enhance fishing opportunities for saltwater anglers and divers along the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico's seafloor is mostly comprised of a vast, featureless plain of mud and sand, and lacks natural reefs or structures for marine animals and plants to settle upon. That's where artificial reefs come into play. Artificial reefs have historically been placed in aquatic environments, coastal, marine, and freshwater, to enhance the receiving ecosystems. With a generous monetary donation from the Coastal Conservation Association and other partners' donation of deployment materials, this new reef is focused on repurposing and reusing various outdated materials, obsolete concrete and metal pieces that would otherwise sit in a landfill, serving no purpose. Thanks for listening.
A Fish with Many Aliases, Going Coastal by Kelly Gross, Texas Fish and Game contributing editor. Cobia, also referred to as ling crabiator or lemonfish, are a welcomed sight for any angler on the Texas coast this time of year. Known for their drag smoking battles and tasty table fare, cobia are a fun fish to go out and target, and luckily for us, these predators can be found swimming around inlets, buoys, oil rigs, and underwater structures. Once spotted, cobia are often mistaken for sharks, but are in no way related to them. Cobia are a part of the Rachycentridae family and are built with a streamlined and powerful body with brown and white lateral stripes, a distinctive long dorsal fin, a forked tail, and have both a wide head and mouth. Their mouth and jaw is lined with villiform teeth designed for prevent prey escape. Although not related, cobia do not have a swim bladder just like sharks, mackerel, and flounder. This means they can only maintain their position in the water column by actively swimming. All types of fish and fishing are great, but the visual stimulation of seeing a snook hit a topwater or watching a tarpon roll is what really exhilarates me. That's why fishing for cobia is one of the top on my list. Cobia are not bashful by any means. In fact, they are curious and inquisitive. Captain Brian Barrera and I like to fish a few nearshore underwater shipwrecks for ling, and I've learned to be ready to cast for these fish as soon as we start approaching the spot. Cobia congregate around these structures, and as soon as they hear our motor, they start making their way to the surface and surrounding the boat. Cobia will eat both real and artificial baits, but they can be picky choosers. Depending on their mood, a ling will come right by the boat and inhale your lure, or literally put their nose on it and reject it. I highly suggest having both lures and live or dead bait ready to offer them. Swim baits and topwaters are popular artificials to use, and live mullet or crabs are a cobia's favorite. On my last outing for ling, I had a DOA bait buster, mullet imitation, with 40-pound leader ready to serve them. I cast my lure by the school, and with a constant retrieve worked the lure right under the water's surface. Four or five ling were fighting over my lure and trying to eat it at the same time. I hooked up to one, and Captain Barrera cast a large topwater into the commotion and got one too. After we landed those, the school disappeared. We were spot-locked on top of a sunken ship in about 60 feet of water using the Minn Kota Riptide Instinct trolling motor, and with the detailed down and side imaging of the Humminbird Solix 12, we could see that the school had gone down into the wreckage. Using a Shimano Terramar 8-foot extra-heavy rod with a 6,000 Spheros reel, we threw out a live mullet rigged on a bottom weight down below. It didn't take long for one of those ling to sniff out that bait, and we hooked up. It is important to have a rod with some backbone and proper leader line to effectively pull them out of the structure, especially since cobia can reach upwards of 100 pounds. Fighting these powerful predators in deeper water is a fun and rewarding battle. Growing up, I remember the pure excitement on my dad's and his fishing buddies' faces when they would spot a school of ling while offshore fishing. Madness would ensue as they cast any and everything they had on board at these fish. I understand the thrill, as catching one is an achievement, and the meal around the dinner afterwards is exceptional. Cobia meat is white, firm, and has a delicious buttery ocean taste to it, thanks to their high-protein diet made up of mostly crab. Once cooked, the fillets are perfectly flaky and don't fall apart like some other fish fillets do. A simple pan sear or blackening on these fillets is all you need. I guarantee you will have no problem finding a few friends or family members to join you for dinner if this is what's on the menu. Good luck in your pursuit of this magnificent and interesting species this fall. Email Kelly Gross at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening.
Excitement in autumn. The Fish and Game Forecast Center. Upper Coast Focus. Sabine Area. Reported by Captain Eddie Hernandez. It's a great day to be an outdoorsman. These next 2 months are special and should rank very close to the top of most hunters' and anglers' list of favorites. Outdoor activities that had been placed on the back burner during the sweltering summer months are now shifting rapidly toward the front. Even though it may not feel like it just yet, there is definitely something in the air reminding us that seasonal changes are very much within our grasp. It is now time to start thinking seriously about practicing with your bow, mowing and trimming at the deer lease, stocking a pond on dove load, and of course, fishing. Here on Sabine Lake, the big three are feeding aggressively and taking a variety of artificial lures as well as the real thing. It's as if they can sense the changing of the seasons well before we can feel it. Meanwhile, the heat wave continues to linger, but knowing what the coming weeks will bring is enough to get us, as well as the bait and fish, excited. Fishing the mouths of Willow and Bridge Bayous should produce some pretty impressive stringers of trout, reds, and flounder. These areas have a long history of attracting and holding bait fish and are go-to spots for many Sabine anglers year-round. Good tidal movement keeps shad, shrimp, mullet, and glass minnows moving in and out. That, in turn, keeps the hungry predators on the prowl. These fish will gladly accept any of these baits, as well as an assortment of artificials. Great choices for soft plastics include DOA Cal Series, Down South Lures, and Zoom Superflukes. Topwaters such as She Dogs and Skitterwalks in Bone and Pink Silver, plus Catch 2000s and Gold Spoons, should also get good results. Good tidal movement is important, so plan accordingly. Work both points over really well and pay particular attention to areas where the current forms small eddies. Trout and redfish usually like it either bounced off the bottom or worked a little higher in the water column. Key on areas that are holding bait, and if you're lucky enough to see shrimp skipping within range, cast as close to it as possible. For flounder, slowly drag a gulp swimming mullet or curl tail grub tipped with fresh peeled shrimp on an 1/8-ounce lead head. Once you feel the trademark thump, give it a couple of seconds, then pop him really good to ensure the hook is buried in its bony mouth. Another proven option for flounder is to rig your lure about 2 feet under a popping cork, cast up current and let the tide drag it. Look for subtle changes in the cork, because more often than not, a flounder won't take it under. If it starts to lean and stops moving, reel in the slack and set the hook. Enjoy this special time of year, and good luck in whatever outdoor activities you pursue. Maybe we'll see you here on Sabine. Contact Captain Hernandez at ghgs.eddie@gmail.com or go online to goldenhookguide.com. Thanks for listening. Back to school. The Fishing Game Forecast Center. Upper Coast Focus. Galveston Bay Complex. Reported by Captain Derek York. School has been back in session for a few weeks, with summer coming to an end after a few very hot months. This is also the time of year that redfish start to school up as well, to feed on migrating bait pods and to head offshore to spawn in the Gulf. But they are not the only ones. Speckled trout are also cruising the bays in deeper waters and marsh drains, looking for easy meals. Early fall brings lots of opportunities in the outdoors, from dove and teal to football and fishing. It's a great time to spend on the water with less people crowding the boat ramps and excellent fishing to be had. I spend a lot of time taking people to chase redfish at the jetties and along the beachfront. We are mostly targeting the larger bulls with cut bait on the bottom, but you will eventually run into some surfacing schools of redfish, which are quite a sight to see. When fishing the jetties, I usually position my boat to allow us to fish the rocks with lighter gear, and then have 2 to 4 rods rigged up for fishing the bottom on the opposite side, out towards deeper water, away from the rocks. One of the cool things we have been seeing more and more of when cruising just offshore is large schools of tarpon surfacing. Tarpon have quite a devoted following here in Texas, with its own set of preferred types of lures, but they are very opportunistic feeders and will surprise people every once in a while and take a piece of cut bait or live bait. You better hold on when that happens. Back in the bay, speckled trout fishing remains strong when drifting oyster reefs in deeper water with soft plastics and croaker. I like to make long casts with this type of fishing and prefer to use 3/8-ounce or 1/2-ounce jig heads to get the bait out there. When using live bait, I will tie about 18-inch of fluorocarbon leader to a chatterweight with a kale hook. This works much like a Carolina rig for bass fishing. Both are very productive when on fish. Always keep your eye out for slicks popping up and seagulls as a clue to where these trout are located on the reefs. Black drum, sheep's head, sharks, and other species such as triple tail and jack crevalle are also around in decent numbers this time of year in all the usual places. I'm always looking out for floating debris and crab traps with any types of shadows next to them. These are perfect locations for triple tail to be hiding to ambush bait fish. The jacks are easy to see when they are busting bait on the surface and are a blast on light and heavy gear. Just make sure you have enough line on your spool. So be sure to get out and enjoy this time of year on Galveston Bay, and remember to take someone new fishing. Contact Captain York at spotstalkerfishing@sbcglobal.com or go online to spotstalkerguideservice.com. Thanks for listening. Ready for the fall? The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Upper Coast Focus, Matagorda Bay Complex, reported by Captain Mark Telesek. I hope everyone enjoyed their summer vacation and were able to spend some time on the water. Maybe one of you won a prize in the Star Tournament. It's been another hot one. I'm ready for some fall weather and football. This is one of the best times for fishing of the year. The first cool front is going to trigger the shrimp migration into the Gulf. Schools of shrimp will slowly head south during the back of a full moon. trout and redfish will school up as well to feed. When you catch one fish, another one will usually be close. If you're wading, stay in the area and fan cast before moving on. If you're drifting, circle back around quietly if you quit getting bites. These fish will disperse if spooked. Live bait always works well, but artificial does just fine in the fall. The jetties can be a hot spot as well. North winds become more common, in turn, calming the surf. The shrimp migrate through these channels, which can create a feeding frenzy. I have seen acres of reds on top of the water around the jetty this time of the year. Beautiful gold rafting on the surface. It's a sight to see. Trout and reds will gorge themselves preparing for the cold winter. Most any bait you throw will draw a strike. When the wind blows, one of my favorite spots is the diversion channel, where it dumps into West Matagorda Bay. The shorelines provide protection from heavy winds. There are oyster reefs littered along the grassy shores. This provides protection from predators for shrimp and other bait. Scores of redfish roam these areas. I mainly use a popping cork to keep from hanging up on the reefs. This is another place where reds pod up and feed. Trout numbers seem to be rebounding from the freeze a few years ago. Lower bag limits and conservation have helped. Most of the tournaments have adopted catch, weigh, and release, or live weigh-ins. With the number of tournaments, this has allowed the population to mature more. Practicing catch and release is also important. Flounder numbers remain constant to previous years, just a slight decline, but the past several years have been stellar. For those wanting to experience what the bay system possesses, gigging at night is an adventure. You can see everything in the bay system from the lighted boat. Flounder migrate every year, so cold weather doesn't affect them as much. Give me a call for your next adventure to Matagorda. Contact Captain Talasek at marktalasek@sbcglobal.com or go online to talasekguideservice.com. Thanks for listening.
Tactics for Fall Fishing. The Fish and Game Forecast Center. Middle Coast Focus. Port O'Connor. Reported by Captain Kim Golden. As we move through the dog days of summer, our attention turns towards fall with cooler temperatures and hungry fish. If you like fishing during summer, you will absolutely love it in the fall and winter. When air temps begin to decrease, water temperature will do the same. Cooler water will encourage targets like speckled trout to hang around shallow water longer. A flat with sand pockets, grass beds, proximity to deeper water, flipping bait and water movement is going to be a good bet. If you're interested in fishing with artificial lures, this can be a great time of year to try them out. Below are a few common challenges I see during fall, early winter, and some suggestions. 1. Changing wind direction or no wind. Wind plays a significant role in water movement. Water movement is important for fish to eat. If you have no wind or tidal movement, find a point with adjacent drop-offs. Water will naturally gravitate around this type of structure, giving you some movement. Even the slightest puff of breeze can immediately result in a bite. Frequently changing wind direction often requires adjustments from anglers. This can be a tough one. There's no one rule for this. You may be able to adjust your direction and/or presentation to continue drawing a bite, or you may have to relocate altogether. 2. Lure weight. When targeting speckled trout in shallow water, try lighter jig heads. Avoid using heavy jig heads to lengthen a cast. That heavy jig head will dive bomb to the bottom and/or wear out your arm trying to keep it in the strike zone. Instead, opt for a 16-ounce with a smaller hook gap and pair with a Miro Lure Lil John XL. This combination casts like a bullet and provides plenty of erratic action with minimal effort. Trout, redfish, and flounder are often willing on this combination. Texas Custom Lures 1/16-ounce 2-0 watermelon red jig head with a watermelon red glitter mirror. Lil John XL is a deadly combination. 3. Approaching your fishing area too fast. Once you have selected the area you want to fish, slow down and idle up to the area or use a trolling motor. This will give you time to evaluate bait presence, water movement, and color changes. Being stealthy by easing into an area quietly and walking a little bit if you are wading can work big in your favor. Bumped fish may still eat, but spooked fish may take much longer to return to normal. If you are new to fall and winter fishing, consider putting this on your short list this year. It truly is a magical time of year on the Texas Gulf Coast. As always, be safe and be nice to each other on the water. Tight lines. Contact Captain Golden at kimgoldenfishing@gmail.com or go online to portoconnorfishingtrip.com. Thanks for listening.
Summer's Last Stand. The Fish and Game Forecast Center. Middle Coast Focus. Rockport. Reported by Captain Jared McCulloch. September, the final stand of summer, with high temperatures and low winds, can turn any favorite shoreline into a dud. But there are still plenty of great areas to find feeding fish. Locations with current movement, such as the surf, are ideal. While it can be a long run, the fast action with reds and trout will have you back at the dock before the temperatures soar. The bigger the croaker, the better if you venture out there. If you prefer lures, the surf can still be your friend. Large topwaters to get their attention, big 6-inch shrimp from DOA on a popping cork, and 5 or 6-inch swim baits of your favorite brand can keep your line tight. Color-wise, I like to keep it simple with natural colors in the surf, as the water is clean with minimal visibility issues. If September's conditions aren't to your liking, waiting for the first cold front demonstrates stellar patience and self-control, allowing the flats to return to normal. Pothole fishing with cut piggies can produce plenty of angry bites and hard takes. Don't be afraid to work on your casting accuracy and aim for the small holes. You will be impressed at how many bites come from a hole not much bigger than a slot redfish, so don't discount a little sand patch. Don't get discouraged if the open sand against an island doesn't have fish. Back it up further and further off until you find them. Generally, strong overnight tides will have these reds all over creation. The same goes for wading with lures. If you get a bite out of a sand pocket, work that lure through it every which way you can. Plum colors and medium-sized lures tend to be my go-to in the fall. October holds one of my favorite stretches of fishing, and possibly some of my customers' favorite fishing as well. Bull reds pile up at the jetties, waiting on the next tide swing to push in and back out. Break out the heavier rods and 50-pound leader. You will need it. Swapping to circle hooks helps you wiggle free from the rocks without breaking off, and also reduces throat and gill hooks, ensuring a healthy release of these old breeders. Bucktail jigs with 2 or 3 ounce weights work great this time of year, especially when you add a dead shrimp to the jig. Don't forget to vent these reds before release to ensure they can return to depth quickly. Good luck out there and tight lines. Contact Captain McCulloch at firstlighttexas@gmail.com or call 210-478-6519. Thanks for listening. Storming into fall, the Fish and Game Forecast Center. Middle Coast Focus, Upper Laguna Madre. Reported by Captain Richard Thompson. The sun had barely crested the horizon, casting a soft, golden glow over the shoreline. There, amidst the symphony of morning birds, was the sound of trout gulping on their topwater delights of shad and shrimp. This scene sets the stage and what becomes the reality for us wade fishermen's happiness and tranquility. It's all about the entirety of the experience for fishing in our South Texas coastal heaven. In the month of September, we still are not out of the woods for tropical weather and disturbances in our Gulf system. Depending on the size and where the systems come in, it can have either a positive or negative effect for your bay system. For instance, there was a storm that landed below Brownsville, and we are about 100 plus miles north here in the Upper Laguna. The storm surge had pushed water into areas and flooded flats that we weren't used to fishing. We were able to target the roaming reds cruising these areas because of the lower barometer, and the bite was phenomenal, as these reds were in a feeding frenzy, devouring our baits. On the other hand, it can flush the bay system with new clean water from the Gulf, which also assists with the cleaning of our floating grass we must deal with after the dog days of summer have beaten down our ecosystems. A typical pre-fall morning starts at 6 a.m., as we too want to send out the breakfast bell to our targeted species of trout and redfish. The strategy we focus on during this time of year hasn't changed much, as our summertime patterns are still in play. Our mornings start off by wading shallow shorelines with sand pockets, and we'll have a drop-off close by as these fish troll looking for easy bait. We want to ensure we can grab their attention with a smaller topwater lure. For example, Mansfield Knockers is one of my favorite go-to. When I change over to soft plastic, I personally like to go to one of my confidence setups, which consists of a Salty Head Pink Lead and a Miro Lure Lil John Purple Demon if I'm wanting a smaller profile soft plastic. If I'm wanting a larger profile, I go to a variety of Coastal Brew bait colors. There's a lot to be said, proving the hookup ratio is greater when one uses what they are comfortable and confident using. We now transition and position ourselves at drop-offs as the afternoons remain warm in the mid-80s to mid-90s. The water temperature reflects the same, and the fish begin to ascend to the cooler, deeper waters. These drop-offs do not have to be tremendously deep. A foot or two is where the fish have moved to. We will change our lead head to an 1/8 or quarter ounce to get our bait down to where the fish are suspended. This time of the year can provide some unforgettable memories and moments on the water, so reach out to us here at R&K Coastal Outfitters. We will hook you up. Contact Captain Thompson at rnkcoastaloutfitters@gmail.com or go online to rnkcoastaloutfitters.com. Thanks for listening. Who Picks Up the Tab? Aptitude Outdoors by Paul Fusinski, Texas Fish and Game Contributing Editor. We all have our passions in the outdoors. For some, it's hunting big game. For others, it's hooking into huge largemouth bass, and some enjoy scanning the flats for redfish. The one thing we all have in common is a shared passion for wildlife, conservation, and the great outdoors. America is unique in that not only do we have public lands, but we also allow our citizens, every single one of them, the opportunity to hunt and fish. This enjoyment, because of a few visionary individuals, comes with the added benefit of aiding in conservation efforts across the country. This conservation by proxy, in short, was created because of issues in the country's past, such as market hunting and the unbridled use of the land, with little understanding of the implications this would have down the road. Regulations are now in place, and hunting licenses and excise taxes have been established to ensure there are resources available to help keep wildlife populations at healthy levels and to fund all the parts of the machine that make conservation efforts possible: restoration projects, research, salaries, etc. According to a recent article by Russ Mason in Michigan, Out of Doors magazine, an Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies study showed that of the $3.7 billion collected in 2019, 70% came from only three funding sources: hunting and fishing license sales, 43%, Pittman-Robertson, excise tax on hunting equipment, 18%, and Dingell-Johnson, excise tax on fishing equipment, 8%. This means that the majority of Americans are paying little to nothing that contributes towards the conservation of wildlife. There have been attempts to broaden the funding mechanisms that contribute to conservation in the past, such as the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, RAWA, but when push came to shove, this bill failed to pass. RAWA would have added $1.3 billion annually for state and tribal wildlife conservation efforts and targeted the conservation of a wider array of species than game animals. This hesitation to create new funding sources beyond the traditional hunting and fishing community perpetuates the continued dependence on these groups to finance most conservation efforts. I've been seeking information that shows the contrary, and all roads have led back to the hunting as conservation model, otherwise known as the North American model of wildlife conservation, as the major funding method for wildlife conservation in North America. Some studies, nothing more than anti-hunting activist articles on their websites, have stated that this is a fallacy, but they provide no substantial evidence or use data that left out key funding sources such as license sales, Pittman-Robertson, or Dingell-Johnson. As it stands, hunters and anglers, whether willingly or not, are footing the bill for conservation efforts in America. This is a great responsibility. If we want the game we love to be around, we must act and spend accordingly. We also need to be active in discussions and issues that arise when it comes to holding on to our right to hunt and fish. There are many groups out there dedicated to taking away, piece by piece, our ability to continue this great American tradition of hunting and fishing. This is exacerbated by infighting within the hunting and fishing community. We do not need to agree on every aspect of hunting and fishing, but we must get on the same page when it comes to protecting resources for future generations. I just watched the state of Michigan close hunting on coyotes with no scientific evidence to explain why. See the feature story on page 24 for more on this. Ballot box biology is becoming more and more common, and I hate to say it, but it is our fault. Outdoorsmen and women are footing the bill for the conservation, yet are keeping our mouths shut when anti-hunters, and in some cases hunters, come after the sport. We should be advocating to maintain all types of hunting and fishing as long as they are legal and not detrimental to the overall health of the species. Just because you don't hunt birds doesn't mean if you see groups coming after bird hunting, you shouldn't care. You're on the chopping block. It's just not your turn yet. As Fred Bear once said, if you are not working to protect hunting, then you are working to destroy it. This goes beyond funding mechanisms, personal hobbies, and legislative decisions. This is about standing up for your rights as an American and keeping alive a tradition that we all love so much. The easiest way to get involved and make a difference is to join a conservation organization. They can amplify your voice and do all the messy legal and lobbying work that we all want little or nothing to do with. Donate whatever you have more of, money or time, to organizations that contribute to conservation efforts. Stay informed by keeping up to date on conservation issues like you're doing right now by reading this. If you have the ability, attend the public forums that your state wildlife agencies hold to get feedback about regulations and laws. Trust me, the anti-hunters are showing up, and we all need to start as well. The North American model has not only been revolutionary in how it has recovered many game species, but also has made sure these efforts are funded and maintained by the ones who care and are most connected to the wildlife and beautiful outdoor spaces that this country has to offer. Us, the outdoorsmen and women of this great nation. We have shown time and time again that we are proud and willing to put our money where our mouth is when it comes to conservation, as opposed to those who talk. But when it comes time to open their wallets, are nowhere to be found. Think RAWA. Don't let outside influences take away your rights to hunt or fish. Get involved, stay involved, and fight for what is yours. Email Paul Fusinski at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. This concludes this audio edition of Texas Fish and Game Magazine, September-October 2024. We hope you have enjoyed this issue. Print and digital versions of this publication are available on our website, fishgame.com. This has been a production of Texas Fish and Game Publishing Company, LLC. Copyright 2024. All rights reserved.